Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. It's been broadcast on community radio in Preston, Swindon and St Albans, where on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, the second part of an interview with Joanna Blythman. She's the author of Swallow This, Dark Secrets of the Food Industry. That's followed with a disturbing discussion with Sam Hill and Jenny Grace, both victims of child sexual abuse. Sam wrote a book in 2008 called An Oath to Hell, and Jenny wrote a book called Nowhere to Belong under a pen name Harmony Brooks back in 2009. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk, and if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897, or prsc.org.uk online. Also, you can go to Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Joanna Blythman, and I'm an investigative food journalist. I've written seven books about food issues, and the latest one is called Swallow This. The strapline is dishing up the food industry's darkest secrets. I think the thing is there's different sorts of labelling. So look, there's really three tiers of thing, different sort of thing under the heading, general heading label. So there is what's on the front of the pack. And essentially that's marketing. That's trying to get you to buy something. And that is controlled up to a point by law, but it's more like don't push your luck or overdo it and we won't intervene. So quite often, for example, I'll see things like the picture on the front of the pack looks absolutely nothing like the contents inside. Very, very misleading. So you see this really attractive looking meal and then you open this thing that looks like a sort of Ryanair ready meal and you think, like, you know, the two don't tally. I'll often see things like a dish described as stir-fried chicken with black beans and noodles. And then I'll look at the actual composition of it and find that there's far more noodles than there is chicken. And in fact, there's hardly any chicken in there at all. It's nearly all noodles. But the picture on the front makes it look as if it is. So that's quite standard. So the front of the pack.
But hang on, isn't that illegal, surely, to show you something that you think you're buying this, but actually you're buying something completely different. You're buying a whole bunch of noodles with a couple of bits of chicken in.
You know, it happens really quite a lot. And unless someone challenges it and goes to sort of the equivalent of what my granny used to call the weights and measures people, who don't really exist anymore because they've all been cut back or rationalized into other departments, trading standards. Unless someone challenges that, takes them to the Advertising Standards Authority or something like that, those sort of claims are really largely unmonitored. Now, when we shop, most people look at that and this is what they trust. Now, the actual more substantive factual information that is legally governed is on the back of the pack. Now, right away, most people really don't look at the back of the pack, so they won't pay too much attention. So that the ingredient listing has to conform to certain legal standards, but these are quite weak. For example, I might be able to say contains egg, but I wouldn't have to say that it was powdered, rehydrated milk with water, for example, egg with water. Another example is cheese. Most cheese you'll pick up will just say on the back that it's made with milk. It won't tell you that, in fact, that milk was dried milk concentrates, which were reconstituted with water. You won't find that out from the label. So that even the legal ingredients listing is weak. And then there's a nutrition label. Now, apart from coming across speaking to people who are actually trained dietitians, I have never met anyone who either A, reads in a nutrition label, or B, understands how to read in a nutrition label. But that's sort of, so that's basically, you can ignore that. And then there are also on the front of the pack and all over the back as well, all sorts of bits of information jumping out at you, like traffic lights, high, low fat, high protein, no unnatural this, no artificial that, and all that sort of noise, that din of information.
No, I mean you're talking about things like when it says no added sugar. Really, what that probably means is that it's got something like saccharin or aspartame in.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It probably has artificial sweeteners in it. Another very common one on children's food would be no artificial colorings, because sweetie manufacturers know that parents are quite rightly very concerned about the idea that colorings can make children, react quite badly, hyperactive even. So they put something like no artificial colorings on the front of the pack, and they don't then point out, but they still have these things called natural colorings in inverted commas. And natural colorings, as I've investigated in Swallow This, are an absolute con, because although they may start with something natural that you or I might perceive as being natural, that ingredient, the named ingredient, the process for making them is so utterly unnatural that they really shouldn't be called that. So that's a scam, really.
Now, if we go down to the fresh food department for a minute in our local supermarket, it looks absolutely wonderful. There's lots of very bright green lettuces, fresh fruit everywhere. But some of this may even still have pesticide residues on it. I mean, I wonder if that's a concern, and if what we can do to know whether there's actually pesticides on our fresh food, because quite often that, of course, is just going to be invisible to our eye.
Well, it is invisible to the eye. Now, the thing here is that if you buy organic food, you can be sure that you aren't getting pesticide residues. If you're buying non-organic food, no one is testing thoroughly to see what level these residues are. So there is something called the Pesticide Safety Directorate, which has a sort of what they call a rolling program of sampling. So they sample of all the fruit and vegetables that you can list for me tonight. They'll take, say there was 200 on that list, they'll maybe decide that over a 5-year period, they're going to test maybe 27. When it comes to these 27, then there'll be a very small number of samples, taken, say 15 of each category. And then they'll extrapolate from those results the risk. So if the idea that all categories of fruit and vegetables are being permanently tested by some government authority on a regular basis is absolute, it's a Janet and John story. It's just not the case. So what we do know, and even by government figures, which are probably underestimating the risk because there is just so little testing being done, we do know that 50% of fruit and vegetables that we buy, the non-organic ones, contain pesticide residues. And of that some fruits and vegetables contain multiple residues, i.e. they have residues of more than one pesticide, and occasionally, and not that occasionally, pretty regularly, some of those are over what's regarded as the acceptable daily dose.
Now, are these pesticides dangerous? I mean,
because they are
supposed to kill these little bugs,
That's
aren't
right.
they? And those bugs don't die easily.
No. They're designed to kill something. So, they're poisons, they're toxins. So the idea that there's a safe level, in inverted commas, of pesticides is in itself very, very debatable. And what's happening now is that, despite the fact people have been banging on about this for years, there is still no testing done on the cocktail effect. So that is the combination of having small, tiny residues of certain pesticides in combination in your diet over a long period of time.
So can we actually get rid of these pesticides by washing vegetables, things like that?
No, you can't. So basically, most pesticides are systemic. That is, they're in the kind of cell structure of the fruit or vegetable. And there's some that are possibly you will remove most of them either by taking off the outside. But the majority, no, you can't get rid of a pesticide residue. And what we're now learning as well is that more research, little research has been done on this, because it would only be independent scientists who do it, and they mainly can't get the funding.
See, the irony here is that the supermarkets demand a very high quality standard kind of products, don't they? Like a tomato that's got to be just exactly the right shape and size. So they are actually driving the whole pesticide industry.
Well, the thing is that, you see, supermarkets will basically say to, say, if you're a pear grower, they'll say, look, we don't want little pears, very big pears. What we want is packs of four pears, and the pears must all be of so many centimetres and so many centimetres through the middle, bloody, bloody, blah. And what happens is, you know, if you've got a pear tree in your own garden or orchard, you will get a spectrum of sizes. So what you can do, and if the supermarkets won't take the sizes, that means it's probably about 40 to 60% of your crop is unsellable to them, because they're just picking off those sort of standard sizes in the middle. So you can, for example, use a pesticide like chlormiquat, which is a growth regulator, and that will tend to make your pear trees produce more uniform fruits. I mean, that's the sort of thing that's going on all the time. And it's all to do with the fact that supermarkets are obsessed, mistake quality with uniformity and sort of visual perfection. But it's a kind of weird perfection. I mean, I'm always reminded of in Snow White, when the evil queen is trying to get Snow White to eat that red apple, and you're sitting there thinking, don't eat it, Snow White. And, you know, it just looks larger than life, that perfect red apple. And for me, that's almost symbolic of the supermarket's concepts of quality. It's all about appearance, and it's nothing to do with real quality. And they're also not at all interested in what I would call genuine biodiversity. So they're not interested in unusual varieties, and by that I mean varieties that were part of our horticultural heritage and we've been eating for centuries. They're not interested in small cultivars of different varieties of this. They want standard commercial hybrid varieties that produce identical looking produce year in, year out. You know, they're just they're very ruthless, the supermarkets, in their sourcing. So they have no loyalty to the people who are growing for them or producing for them.
But one thing I will say, just on behalf of the co-op, is one of the co-ops, I think it's the one in Newent, I go into occasionally, I'm not sure if it's in Gloucestershire or Wales, but it's round about there somewhere. They have a quite a large section just devoted to kind of products from local areas and local growers. I wonder, you know, this isn't really happening much with the big supermarkets though, is it?
Well, I don't think it is. I mean, they're very tokenistic about local produce. I mean, I think they will have a few brands, but if you were actually to kind of quantify them, if you think the average supermarket has about 32,000 lines, so that would be a big, you know, not a super superstore, but the sort of next format down, would have about 32,000. And how many of those would be genuinely local? My estimate would be less than 1%.
Now, there are some places in the world that don't allow supermarkets, not many, because they do seem to have kind of got rid of much of our, you know, variety and certainly freshness when it comes to things like greengrocers and places like that. But what about one of the other sides of all of this is irradiation. This is something that I can remember reading about years ago, and it sort of completely disappeared off the headlines, the idea that some of our food might actually be irradiated with ionizing radiation. That is, you know, sort of the sort of thing that you might find in a nuclear power station.
Yes, that's right. Well, you see, the food industry has a problem with safety. If you just have a small, you know, lots of small producers, if something goes wrong, the sort of ramifications of that tend to be quite localized and quite fixed in an area. It's quite easy to pin down who caused it. But when you've got a global food industry which is transforming ingredients in factories all over the world, and shipping them to different manufacturers and down different supply chains, vast quantities of food. You really do, the risks are heightened. And so there are big food poisoning risks. There was a time, and I would say it's probably more like the 90s, the 1990s, when food irradiation was touted around as being the solution. So if for example, something like chicken, which is notoriously likely to give you food poisoning and really, really likely to be unsafe. The idea was that you would bombard the meat with radiation and seafood was another category cited, and this would make it render it safe, in inverted commas. And of course, at the time, campaign groups and food activists just said, well, you know, this is not our idea of clean, safe food. Good food shouldn't need to be irradiated. And largely that argument prevailed in Europe, not in North America, where they do still irradiate food more than us. But in Europe, the conclusion was that really there should be no need for irradiation except for a very limited number of categories. And the key one is ground spices. So if you have something like huge silos that are just full of paprika that's been ground, it's very easy for them to become contaminated. And so these companies can apply for a license to irradiate.
Certainly if it's sitting around for years or whatever without actually being used. So how do I know if my mixed spice I buy at Tesco's has been put through the nuclear conveyor belt? They have some kind of nuclear source right next to it.
To my knowledge, there's no way, I'm afraid to say that there is no way. And I would just point out that there are other technologies now that that are being touted around that are seen as being better than food irradiation. So this is things like various washes of things like raw chicken meat, not sort of chlorine-based washes, acid washes that are kind of using kind of vinegar-type bacteria.
Well, excuse me, but I don't really want to have acid or chlorine in my chicken, thank you.
Well, it's not your idea of clean, and I'm surprised, pulling your leg there. But I mean, no, I mean, who wants that, you know? And I mean, one of the things that I came across when I was researching Swallow This was, I laugh, but actually, it's horrible. You know, I'd always, you know, these sort of washed salads where it says, some say, you know, wash at home, but many of them say washed and ready to eat. And you think, wash, that sounds great, that sounds clean. But the idea, what washing means in food industry is that you have a sort of continuous batch of lettuce, say, that are coming in one door. They're broken down. They're put into a large sort of tank of water, which will be dosed with chlorine, i.e. like sort of swimming pool, and then fruit acids, which have another kind of sterilizing kind of effect, or at least keep the lettuce looking fresher than it is, and occasionally enzymes in that water. And that mix, that bath, sort of will be there in that so-called washing line for maybe 6 to 8 hours at a time before anyone changes. And all the time, the washed lettuces are just going through it and then being dried and being bagged.
And this is all so that it can look nice on the supermarket shelf for a couple of days longer.
Yeah.
I mean, there's also the biggie, which is genetically modified food. Do you think there's any actual danger in eating genetically modified food, and is it properly labelled?
Well, I do think there are dangers to do with genetically modified food, and I don't think there clearly are environmental dangers, but I think there are human health and animal health dangers, and there are enough examples now of research that have been done on animals.
So what examples are there of, you know, somewhere where people eating food or animals that have been fed genetically modified, are there any examples?
Yeah, well, if you look at Professor Seralini's studies in France, you're looking at small rodents developing really quite major cancers. And often it's hard to separate out whether this is actually to do with the genetic modification of of the food, or it's to do with the pesticides that have to be used along with these genetically modified crops. But I mean, the real problem with GM is that it's a sort of unpredictable technology. You get one change, but you can't predict the other sort of domino effects that will have. And the kind of things we're talking about are food allergies. So you transfer, an allergen unbeknownst to you by swapping around one gene, you also manage to lose one or add in another that has, for example, is an allergen. And there are, there's some very good independent scientists now built up quite ahead of evidence on the potential health risks from GM.
Now, the food companies are going to say, aren't they, look, we've tested all this stuff, it's safe.
Well, they aren't really. They're just saying, well, we'll go along with the assurance that it is safe because it's more convenient for us to do so.
What about recipe books? Because this is something that everyone should really have in their kitchen, a good recipe book. Can you just recommend one for us?
Recipe book. Well, I use quite a few recipe books, I suppose, I've been cooking for so long that I have quite a few sort of intuition. I suppose I'm a kind of intuitive cook nowadays a lot of the time. My favourite book, if I had to choose one recipe book, is a book that no one will ever heard of. And it was written by a Yorkshire woman called Anne Willen, who went to work at the Cordon Bleu Cook School in Paris. And she wrote this wonderful French cookery. It wasn't French cookery book. I think it might be called The Cordon Bleu Cook. And basically what she does is she teaches you how to make categories of food. So it's the very opposite of a book which says, first do this, first do that, and now you've learned that recipe. It gives you the theory of what you're trying to achieve, and then it gives you recipes to make with them. And I actually, in many ways, learned so much from that book. So if I was someone who was recommending a book for someone who maybe didn't have kind of core cooking skills, it would be Anne Willen. I think it was called the La Varenne Cookbook.
I mean, I just want to put my one in, which is Escoffier's. I don't know if you've come across that, which is he was some kind of French chef that went around, right the way around France, picking up some of the best sauces, mainly sauces from all over France. And that one, I mean, from time to time, if I'm making a special meal, I'll dip into that. Also, finally, what about a kitchen wall chart? Because we really need to have information in our kitchen from you, I think, to tell us how to, just a sort of kind of checklist. Have you got anything like that, or is there anything you could recommend?
Yeah. I wish I did. If I did, I'd probably be a very wealthy person. I'd have cracked it, in tablets of stone. But I would say that I could distill my advice down to three words, which is avoid processed food. And if you said to me, can you just make that shorter? I'd make it one word, cook, just cook. And that's really what you need to know about food.
Is there anywhere we can find you online other than your books we've mentioned?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, my website is joannablythmanwriting.com, and you'll find some of my journalism on that site. But also there's 7 books, and I'm published by Fourth Estate. So it's pretty easy to track down any of my books, and there's quite a complimentary set there. So whether you want all your worst prejudices about processed food to be confirmed, and that you'll buy, then swallow this, or if you want just a really practical, useful guide to how to make daily decisions, that would be what to eat. And if you want to get wound up about something, food issues, whether it's whether or not we should be eating rapeseed oil or food irradiation or whatever it is, then go to my website, joannablythmanwriting.com.
Okay, so I said finally, but I mean, one of the things recently which has been come out is that apparently butter is better for you than margarine. Now, for years, for decades, we were told the opposite.
Yeah, well, really, this may be another, where we're talking about things to put up on your kitchen wall. Another one might be don't trust the government's nutrition advice. I mean, they've got it so wrong, and they've got it wrong because they've had one arm twisted up their back by the food industry. We've been sold a pup. We've been told things like try and lower your cholesterol. Cholesterol's a bad thing. Well, this is nonsense. You need cholesterol for your body to function properly. You need it to make hormones, a whole lot of different biological functions we need. So that is one thing to be ignored. We're told to reduce saturated fats, i.e. things like butter, lard, dripping, you know, coconut oil. We're told these are bad fats. And again, this is wrong. It seems to be quite clear now that these fats are good for us and that it's the polyunsaturated fats which easily corrupt and degrade and become rancid that are bad for us, yet they've been recommended to us. We've been told to base our eating on starchy foods, and this is nonsense as well, because what we know now is that starchy foods make us fat, and that the idea that any healthy diet consists of mounds of refined carbohydrates is very dangerous advice. So my best advice is, you know, I think a lot our diet went wrong when we started deferring to experts, when we started people who call themselves experts, I should say, when we started deferring to the medical lobby, the men in white coats. And actually, we need to go back to kind of common sense approach that your grandmother or your great grandmother would have understood, which is, you know, eat foods that have sustained human population down the centuries, and don't overeat and eat them in their natural form as nature intended. And if you apply those criteria, then you'll certainly not be eating margarine.
And what about fasting? Because that's, you've just talked about people years and decades and decades and maybe a century ago, the way they ate, because people sometimes used to fast for a week or whatever in those days. Is that something that you'd recommend, or is it something that you thought about?
Yeah, this is very interesting. I mean, I'm not an expert on fasting, but I know I've been very interested to read a lot on this subject recently by people who really have studied it. And my feeling is that it won't do you any harm on a short-term basis. But personally speaking, I am what's known in my family as a three square meals a day person. I'm the sort of person who complains if they don't have breakfast, don't know what's for lunch, and there's no sign of dinner. That suits me. So I will eat a very good breakfast. I eat quite a big breakfast, quite a substantial breakfast. I eat a reasonable lunch. I will have a good meal in the evening. I'll probably finish eating that about 7:30 at the latest, and then I won't eat anything at all, nothing, until I get up for breakfast the next day, which is probably about 12 hours later. So in a way, if you eat that way, you're kind of fasting for 12 hours every day. And I think that's a very healthy eating plan. I just don't know about more long-term fasting. And I guess that people could get into kind of, the idea that you can fast and then eat whatever you like to your heart's content for the next few days, and some fasting, not diets, not all of them, but some of them do seem to imply this, that doesn't strike me as being sensible at all. So I think basically stick to meals. I'm definitely not persuaded that snacking is a good idea, or that lots of small meals are a good idea. I do think you need to kind of give your liver a bit of a rest, and you have to just eat, do your eating, do it, satisfy yourself when you do sit down, have enough so that you're not getting hungry quickly, and that food, and then put food out your mind for a few hours, come back to your appetite again, satisfy it, put food out of your mind for hours, and so on. I think that rhythm, it will suit many people.
I'll add something. My own experience of fasting is I was quite surprised that you just don't even feel hungry when you're fasting. It's very strange. I was thinking, oh, crikey, I'm going to be looking for the next meal or whatever. But anyway, Joanna Blythman, what we'll do is we will put links up on our show page, which is dialectradio.co.uk, to your blog and to your books and any other bits of information you gave us there. So if people want to go to that website, they'll get everything and they can go straight to your blog. But anyway, thank you very much for joining us on Dialect.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, our next piece, well, we do this from time to time, but it's pretty disturbing stuff. There's a child sexual abuse VIP defile inquiry going on here in Britain. The only thing is it seems to have been sabotaged. Four different chair people, none of whom would look as if they're actually able to do the job. And we're joined in a minute by two very brave women who went through horrific abuse as children, but they're about to tell their story. So anyone of a sensitive disposition, and particularly children, you may wish to switch off now. Right, well, I'm joined now by Sam Hill and Jenny Grace. Hi, Sam and Jenny. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi, Tony.
Sam, you've been on here before, talking about sexual abuse as a youngster. Just remind us what that was all about.
Well, I started to go to an elite neighbourhood when my grandparents moved there, and it was full of doctors who were friends of my abuser.
And what part of the country?
It was one of the most expensive neighbourhoods in Hertfordshire.
You know, it's not such a surprise, is it? Hertfordshire is incredibly rich. And do you think that that's fair to say there's a connection between this abuse and people who feel so wealthy and privileged that they're almost above the law?
Definitely. The people involved were Etonians, and they said that there were other important people, I was told at the time, who I was going to be taken to meet, but luckily I didn't. I didn't get taken there, but I had a relationship with one of the abusers, and eventually it ended up with me being silenced within mental health.
So you say a relationship. Is that fair, or were you too young, do you think, really, to make
point.
A decision
good
about
point.
Whether it's a relationship
I
or not?
I was being told that he wanted to marry me, and that's why it was so dangerous in the neighbourhood I was living with the people on the peripherals of this and his brother, who was also an abuser, and the doctors, one of whom was at a party where abuse took place. Because I moved into the neighbourhood, I was having a troubled time with my family when I was 16, and
I think so. There's quite a few 16-year-old girls out there that do have a bit of trouble with their family. So do you think that was kind of exploited in a way?
It was, and they wanted to silence me, and it was very easy because I didn't have a supportive family, and I was taken to a top psychiatric hospital at 16.
Now, that idea of not having a particularly emotionally supportive family is true, probably. Same to say for you, Jenny, isn't it?
I was taken into care at 6 weeks old. My foster family were very wealthy. I was fostered in a very wealthy part of Buckinghamshire, again, in a farming village where, sadly, me and my sister were the only black children at that time, so we were really alienated, first of all, as soon as we came, really.
Okay, so you say your sister, is this a foster sister kind?
It is my half-sister.
Okay.
And my foster family only fostered children of different ethnic backgrounds.
So your sister was actually a half-sister, a real half-sister,
yeah.
So they both come from one same parent?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, So what was life like for you there? I mean, you know, and certainly from a very early age, you won't be able to remember, but what are your first memories?
I remember the first memory being taught how to peel vegetables by my foster father, who was an ex-army bloke, and getting it perfectly right. Every time I kind of like didn't get it right, I'd be hit, kicked across the kitchen floor.
Was there any comeback? I mean, you know, did you have any kind of somebody that came to check every once in a while?
We had
social
services came every 6 months, and the house that we lived in, it was a 3-bedroom, small holding where the lounge was the showroom. When anybody came to visit to check on us, the social services came into the lounge, nowhere else. The kitchen they loved animals. So we had dogs, cats, geese, chickens who were allowed to roam around the kitchen. I mean, and it was filled
with
feces.
Obviously, there's some abuse along the line, but, I mean, did you have, you think, a reasonably happy childhood there?
No.
You just wanted to get out?
you're so trained to believe that's all you're worth. I mean, when the abuse, I was about 5 or 6 when he started to sexually abuse me. And I, you know, the reasons were because we were evil and he was sent to clean us. And you really believe that. So to, for us, it was like the world was like that. You know, first of all, going to school, we weren't accepted in the school because we were different. You know, parents were up in arms about us coming in and sitting with their children. You know, at first, my education, and that's what my files, you know, it took 10 years to get my social worker files. On those files, there's things like we believe these children are being abused, but because of their long-term diagnosis of being acutely retarded, they will not give them any long-term effect in the home.
So do you think that there was an element of, well, as black children in that white environment, rich white environment, that you're almost like a fish out of water, you're quite vulnerable anyway? I mean, surely the social services should have made doubly clear that you weren't being abused, for goodness sake.
They knew. In my records, in my social worker records, they knew that we were being sexually abused. But because of our diagnosis, they said that there would be no long-term effect. I started to self-harm at the age of 9. I was sectioned at 11 and diagnosed with schizophrenia. I was on a geriatric ward. I don't know if anybody ever remembers this hospital, St John's in Stone, an old... It was a horrific hospital. I was 11 years old on a old people's ward because there was no room for me.
So in a way, you've got a similar story to Sam, haven't you? The idea of as soon as you start actually kicking back against this sexual abuse as a youngster, you're classed as some kind of mental case.
Yeah. Mm. And sadly, that goes with you for the rest of your life. I mean, you know, I've been from the age of 19, because I've got a daughter who, sadly, as a result of the abuse, I fell pregnant the first time when I was 10 years old and taken to this place, this house in, which I presume was London, because I'd been there before to parties and that, being abused. I was taken there and the baby was aborted. The more you say something, the more, you know, I was sedated. I was given psychotic drugs, knocking me out. I mean, I remember one thing I used to say to him, I'm going to tell of you, you know, and straight away in my backside, an injection, which knocked me out for days. And, you know, your whole being is numb. You can't even lift yourself off the floor. It's like going for an exercise regime because you're just, you're there, but you're not. Your body's not attached to your mind. So you're just so... It's a horrible experience, and the drugs are, because you're not schizophrenic. You're the drugs they give you actually they bring on those psychotic episodes, you know, and so you give them more drugs to counteract those episodes.
It sounds like a form of psychological torture, actually. How old were you when that first started?
I was given ECT at the age of 12 years old, which is, you know, electrical. Nobody explained to me. I was sectioned on a ward. I was, this is again St John's in Stone, taken down to the ward on this bed. I remember being wired up, looking at the nurses, begging them to tell me what was happening, not a clue, and coming round, and it literally felt like my head had been sucked in, you know, like a balloon deflated. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're just, it's slowly, slowly arising. And that in itself makes you feel like you're going to behave.
Well, that's the sort of thing you might expect in warfare, maybe some kind of hideous torture by some despotic regime, but not to a 12-year-old child. Now, Sam, how does this echo with some of your experience?
Well, I heard Jenny speak at a White Flowers meeting in Parliament, and I was very keen to meet her again because I have seen so many psychiatric abuses like this and experienced them. I wrote about it in my book. We even discovered today we were at the same hospital in the 80s, late 80s, and we knew all the same people with same stories.
Well, it's worth mentioning both your books, probably. Sam's is An Oath to Hell, published in 2008, and Jenny's under a pen name, which is, maybe you better tell me.
Harmony Brooks.
Harmony Brooks was published in 2009. Title of your book, Jenny, is Nowhere to Belong. So, yeah, go back to your story. How is all this echoing with your experience, Sam?
Well, the oppression, the loss of almost losing your soul, and but just being... null for so long. Everything was void and just being oppressed. And the moment you do start to come back, they, you know, if you try to say that you don't have an illness, they'll say you have no insight. Mm. It really is a control mechanism that they use on people to oppress. And, you know, I've met so many people with child abuse in the system, had similar stories.
So it's this funded by the taxpayer. It's all part of the government. It seems to me as if, you know, we hear about, don't we, with the Olympics, we had the state-sponsored doping. Well, this sounds to me like state-sponsored child abuse. Mm, mm.
And it's a lot to do with the children without a voice. There was a lot in where I grew up, which was in Prince of Edinburgh, Buckinghamshire. There was a lot of children's homes. And, you know, we were ferried in a minibus back and forth. The children picked up from children's home and doped up either by drugs or drink to be sexually abused. And that was, you know, part of, you know, some of those drugs they gave us were very similar to the drugs we had in hospital. For me to explain this now and then to explain it to someone else, it's just, you actually think you're going mad. So, you know, people think you're going mad because it's just so, this is the UK, this wouldn't happen. But there's so many people out there that it's happened to and are too scared to come forward. Because
What about naming some names of potentially people like doctors, people who you believe have sexually abused you in the past, places where this might have happened? Because, of course, we've got this child sexual abuse inquiry, the VIP defile inquiry, they call it, which is now on its fourth chairman, an absolute mess, actually. I think probably deliberate mess. Started off with Fiona Wolfe as the chair, then we had Baroness Butler-Schloss as the chair, both of whom had connections to abusers and people who had been involved in the past in covering up that abuse, which is really not a very good way to start. But then we had Lyle Goddard from New Zealand, who mysteriously resigned without giving an explanation, and now we've got someone in charge of it called Alexis Jay. She was in charge of the child sex abuse inquiry in Rotherham, which was a very different sort of abuse, which was known about by the authorities, though, and went on for something like 12 years with thousands of children being abused in Rotherham. The most important thing to note about Alexis Jay's inquiry, who's now in charge of this national inquiry, is that not a single public official was made to resign, suffer, etc., apart from one, and that was the police and crime commissioner, who wasn't even in post when this abuse was going on. So no police and no social workers at all have been prosecuted, persecuted, even sanctioned after her inquiry. So it doesn't give you maybe a lot of confidence in this VIP defile inquiry. Mm.
It doesn't give us a lot of confidence, and I'll be totally honest with you now, I'm not happy to name names because, the first of all, I am fighting a case. It's taken me 30 years to get this far. And
Well, this is what the solicitors always say, isn't it? Don't name names now because it might not go down very well in court, blah, blah, blah.
I've been told I don't have a chance in court because I don't have a record of what they did to me at the hospital. There isn't a medical record of it, apparently.
So that's been lost or burnt or whatever, along with lots of other things that
I've got
seem
my
to
records.
Disappear. Yeah.
Mm. Note by note on every page.
So, I mean, the thing is, without naming names, without naming places, I mean, you have with this mental hospital you're talking about, it's very difficult for, even without justice from the justice system, for people to put two and two together, isn't it?
I think they naturally err on the side of the powerful. They don't want to break up the status quo and they keep vulnerable people vulnerable. I think that's what it's designed to do.
I mean, for example, you know, I'm still being found by people who want to shut me up. And, you know, it's just me and my son. We've moved over 30 times just to, you know, keep safe. And last week we felt that we were being followed. And the police came and their attitude, because they saw in the notes that I had mental health problems, their attitude completely changed. They didn't want to help me. I was this crazy person who they just kind of like patronised and pushed in the corner. And that's, you know, whatever happens, our abusers have won because we are left with the labels. We are left with fighting for our rights to be free of the mental health labels. And that will follow on, that will be on our notes to the day we die.
It's not just Britain this has been going on. It's worth pointing out it's 20 years now since the Dutroux affair in Belgium, with this guy, Dutroux, who was actually procuring young children for top politicians in Brussels. And there's a whole list of scores of young girls, mostly, some young boys too, who were initially, most of them, hypnotised by a magician and then handed over to this guy, who would then put them in dungeons where they were sexually abused and then often murdered. And that was all going on. The first arrests were in August, and the biggest demonstration ever in Belgium was in September 1994, exactly 20 years ago, but hardly any talk about that at all. I mean, it does seem to me as if this subject is like we're living out on the South Sea Islands somewhere, and it's a taboo. If you talk about it, you're out. You're just simply not allowed to talk about it. So well done for coming to talk about it. If you'd just like to finish, both of you, with one message for the listeners, what would that be? First of all, you, Jenny.
I'd like to say to social services especially, you know, bring survivors in to teach you the telltale signs. Learn from us, because at the end of the day, our lives, we can't change what's happened to us, but we can change what happens to the future of our children.
And Sam?
Okay, the stigma that's supposed to exist in society about mental health is actually something that's working within the system itself. The stigma, they use the stigma, they pass, they rely on notes which are either written carelessly or can be modified by people with an interest. And if you make a complaint or if you're troublesome, they can, you know, modify the whole thing that's written about you. So people are just being processed. And this really needs to be looked at, and a bit more humanity in dealing with people generally within mental health or who've been abused.
It does seem that there are serious problems with this official inquiry, and also a lot of doubts amongst some still about going to the police. Start with you this time, Sam. What's your advice for anyone out there that knows someone or has themselves been abused? What can you actually do to get together with survivors to get a bit of support?
I'm beginning to think the way forward is to make some of my my experiences public, my notes, some of things that have happened to me, because I'm not getting anywhere with the police. They dropped my case without telling me. They led me along for 6 months. No, very little contact with, and then I was told it was dropped 4 months ago. And the reason being, they found something in my medical notes, which they said was some kind of a contradiction. Somebody agreed with the fact that they thought that we hadn't met and before, even though the ex-wife of the abuser had told the police 20 years ago that we had met. So something written in there was supposed to have contravened all the whole thing. And, you know, they spent the 6 months, most of it going through my medical notes, nothing investigated. I've got a lot of evidence. So I would say if you get to the end of the line, you try everything first, the normal channels. If you don't get anywhere, you can make it public somehow.
Jenny, would you agree? Or what's your advice for listeners if they know somebody, for example, that's been abused?
I would say come alongside that person, support them in every way, believe them. And, you know, maybe not going to the police first of all, maybe looking at a solicitor who will hear your story and having an advocate to go down with you. You need to have some backing to go to the police on your own.
How do you find a good solicitor, though? Because for nowadays, you know, solicitors, good solicitors are, well, they're very rare.
Yeah, and legal aid is being stopped for these cases anyway. So I would say that even an advocate, if you could find an advocate or somebody who's a good friend and insists that they sit in with you, because even records and, you know, recordings of what you're saying are being, you know, lost or misplaced. I was 17 when I first reported it to the police. Then again 23, then again 30, and then again now. And all those times, there's no records of me going there, only in my social work notes.
Same with me. So they lost one of my interviews. They said it couldn't find any record of it. Yeah, and the police.
Why are the police shredding this information? It's absolutely incredible.
I think it's just too messy for people to deal with. People want to deal with things there and then and move on.
And it seems, I mean, we keep coming across these stories in all different parts of the country, these same bad practice by the police. And I'm not saying this is necessarily by the officers or detectives who've interviewed you. Somebody in there is losing this stuff. What about survivors groups? There must be at least two or three which are worth, where you can meet other people and just share your experience and get good advice. Jenny?
I'm volunteer for Reflections UK, and we're trying to find our way and help and support people. But we also want to hear from people on how we can help. It was set up by Jenny Tomlin and Esther Baker. And, you know, it's just early steps. Sometimes we just don't know how to help people, because we need to be jointly singing from the same hymn sheet. And basically,
I found going on Twitter was quite life-changing. First person I came in contact with was Teresa Cooper, because she had a similar experience with being drugged as a child and abuse cover-up. And she's done a lot of work with this. And she was very helpful. Ended up meeting her at a meeting in Hartford where we were trying to get members for the People's Tribunal, which was headed then by Michael Mansfield QC. And I eventually got asked to join their group. But I found being on Twitter actually helpful. On Mondays, they have a talk by somebody called Shiny Blue Dress, where they talk about their experiences and generally network with people. I found it very useful. I wouldn't be here now if it wasn't for that.
Okay.
Can I just say something about the police? I went and did a talk with the police in Brixton. And, you know, Brixton has got a very bad reputation. But the The police officer, the sergeant there, Birkeland, he really wants to come alongside and help those who, and it, you know, who've been abused, and he wants to hear from survivors the best way of coming to dealing with this. There's been some terrible mistakes made, but I think when someone says, "We're sorry, how can we make things okay?" You've got to give them a chance, whether they're pleased, whether whatever, because that's what I would like done to me.
Trouble is, of course, he's only a sergeant. What you need really is someone who's a chief constable or else a home secretary to take this whole thing
seriously. But I think it's got to be baby steps, and it's got to be seen that sometimes it's got to be the smaller people, because the bigger, you know, the people at the top aren't doing nothing. And, you know, we got to start rattling some, we got to. Because that's the only way it's going to be moved forward, or it's just going to be squashed and hidden again.
Well, that one thing's for sure. This VIP default scandal inquiry seems to be going nowhere. So both of you, Sam Hill and Jenny Grace, thanks ever so much for joining us. And all those tips as well on dialect. That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Joanna Blythman, author of Swallow This, The Darkest Secrets of the Food Industry, and also to Sam Hill and Jenny Grace, very brave child sex abuse survivors. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. That's one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk, or you can even use the national volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now. Fact.
walk around with a bigger one. Woo! Woo! I hear it all day, just so they can run the light and be upon their way.
That's the sound of the beast.